to episode 31 of Abbott and Costello Meet the Podcast, Lost in Alaska. I'm Jerry Shario. I am not lost in Alaska. I'm here in Spokane, Washington, and it's my pleasure to introduce to you our host, author, playwright, composer, actor, director, a man who has seen it all but remembers very little of it, Nick Santa Maria.
Oh, stop making fun of my memory, Dave. My goodness, what a terrible thing. No, Steve, you just get me crazy. You really do, Murray. All right, so.
Out of all that, I actually have a brother named Steve, so you hit on one that was close at least.
I never hit on your brother. You know that.
Okay, good.
I don't
good.
Go that way. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but. Hi, everybody. It's me with my scar. And my scar is healing very well, by the way.
Yes.
If you remember our last episode, I had scalped myself in the middle of the night in a sleepwalking fall. And I have to say that the people did an amazing job sewing me up. And here it is. It's great. Anyway, how are you, Jerry? How are things going?
I'm doing very well, sir. Experiencing a little bit of empty nest syndrome here. My son moved out Thursday of last week. And
was the argument bad?
No. He and three friends all got an apartment together, which had been in the works for far too long. By the time it actually came about, it was like, fine, go, get out of here.
Enough already.
Yeah.
So, Jerry, we are dealing with empty nest syndrome. Did they leave any eggs, at least?
They left very little. You know, three 20-something guys. The fridge has never been as vacant as it is now.
Much less their expressions. But this is a big move. This is a big thing.
Yeah.
I get it.
And my wife is taking it just a little harder than I am. But, you know, mothers are like that.
Yeah.
So
I don't know. My mother opened the door and started pointing in the direction of out. You know, so I had a little different experience. Anyway, we are talking about a different experience. How's that for a segue? We are talking about number 31 in their movie career, and that would be Lost in Alaska. Unless you're Bud Abbott, then it's Lost in Alaska. There's an ER at the end of Alaska.
Yep.
And I think George Bush used to do that too. George Jr., Alaska, you know? Yeah. Which really gave me good faith in him. So this is 1952, and let's start right at the beginning. It had a budget of $677,230, which is kind of lower than they were used to, and it shows. In this movie, it shows. It looks like a low-budget comedy that, you know, Brown and Carney would have made, or any of those lesser teams, which is a real shame. But it went on to make, of course, a million and a half. So what am I talking about? who am I to say? It was originally called The Sourdoughs, which I like that title much better than Lost in Alaska, directed by Gene Yarborough, who's been there. In fact, he didn't like the script. Nobody liked the script. Lou liked the script. Or he said he did. He just wanted to get on with it, I think, and make $100,000. But they asked their friend Gene Yarborough to direct this movie, and he said yes, you know, despite him not liking it. Interestingly, it was shot in December of 1951, so it was a winter movie, but it wasn't released until July. So you had a snowy movie. Yeah, I guess it cooled people off, you know, in the middle of the summer. released July 28th, 1952. Took a long time for an Abbott and Costello movie to be edited and released. Originally, the first idea came from Robert Arthur, of course, who claims every idea was his original idea. But that was back in 1949. They came up with this, and while he was still their producer. But it was passed on to their new producer, Howard Christie, who really does a good job. I really like Howard Christie. The story was by a very interesting fella by the name of Elwood Ullman. Now, Elwood Ullman, 1903 to 1985, born in Memphis, Tennessee, wrote humor pieces for humor magazines. he kept sending Columbia Studios, for some reason, he used to send story ideas just at random, you know, while he was working at his typewriter, and he would send them to Columbia, and eventually, not the country, and he would send them to Columbia, and eventually they got around to Jules White, who ran the short subjects department, and he hired him. He hired him as a story man, mostly. And he went on to make, I can't tell you how many, Stooge shorts, Andy Clyde, Hugh Herbert, anyone who was under contract, Buster Keaton, Harry Langdon. I mean, he wrote for all of these people, and he generally teamed up with the director, Edward Burns. And together they really did some, you know, later stuff that was very interesting. A couple of the Stooges features with Curly Joe Derita. I believe he did Hercules and another one of my, not my, oh, In Orbit. Those are, I think, my two least favorites. But Ed Burns always, you know, gave him work. And I have to say that I went to the Stooges star unveiling back in, when was that, 83? And they showed a documentary that is still available, but it's a much shorter version. It was almost 3 hours long, and we were ready to pull our own heads off at that point. It was just, you know, it's like, we don't have to know, you know, what was between Shemp's toes, you know? But they had these interviews. Where the hell did that come from? with Ed Burns on one chair, and on the other chair was Elwood Ullman. And they were both very old and, you know, going off about what it was. But that's what I remember most about Elwood Ullman. And it was that horrible, long documentary. Horrible. But anyway, he died in, what, 1985 at the age of 82, did some fine work, and he wrote the story for this film. The two writers were their two new radio writers, Martin Ragaway and Leonard Stern, both long histories with TV. Leonard Stern became writer-director for Steve Allen when Lou Costello was a semi-regular on the show. So he tells a very interesting story, Leonard Stern does. We talked about them in other episodes, so I'm going to avoid the biography. But Leonard Stern, when he was directing Steve Allen, Lou Costello came up to him. This was 1958, the year before he died and like 2 years after he left Abbott. He apologized to him. He sat down and he said, you know, you wrote us some really nice material, like for Lost in Alaska, and I forget what the other one was just before this. He said, we didn't give it the chance it deserved. We were so head up about, you know, going home and, you know, not giving our best and all this stuff, you know, and in this movie, it looks like, I don't know. There was. We'll talk about it. But he apologized. He sat down and apologized to him. He said, you deserved better, and I'm sorry we didn't give it to you. I love that. Oh. He was actually coming to grips with, you know, the reality of the situation and where they were at the time. But I thought that was really cool.
Yeah.
There is a major story that preceded this movie, when they're making this movie. Eddie Sherman, their manager, who was back in the fold after being fired. He was walking down the street one day. It could have been Hollywood Boulevard, whatever it was. He looked in the window, and there was a huge display of Castle Films, Abbott and Costello movies, cut down versions. And, you know, Jerry, you grew up with them. I did too, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, God. That was our videos, you know, and our DVDs were these 8-minute movies cut down from a, you know, a 75-minute movie. So he sees this, yep, and he goes to Universal and he says, what's going on? Did you read our contract? You could not do this without our approval and our participation. Universal was trying to get away with making this money. And we're talking, it went into the millions. And, Abbott and Costello and Eddie Sherman sued Universal and Real Art, who was reissuing their films already. And some of those were more popular than the new ones, by the way. And he sued them for $5 million, which was an amazing amount back then. This made all the newspapers. It was a big deal. And it turns out that Universal was so embarrassed, because Abbott and Costello really went to work. They looked into what was going on at Universal. Universal was charging $1.5 million of Abbott and Costello's money profit sharing for an apartment for executives who come into town and wanted to meet with hookers and, you know, all of that stuff, all charged to Abbott and Costello. Now, this is still being done today. I mean, I know Eddie Murphy had the big lawsuit against Paramount, and I think he won. Mm-hmm. They were charging everything to his movies. So that's what Universal was doing to Abbott and Costello, and they found out. So this is what Universal did. They called Eddie Sherman, and they said, I want to meet you with no lawyers, just the two of us. I forget who the guy was. Who was it? An executive at Universal. And they met, and the Universal guy said, listen, this is looking bad for our company. Every newspaper article, everything makes us look bad. So let's finish this. Let's do this. And so Eddie Sherman said, fine. Okay. Here's what we want. We want $2 million. They were allowed to own the films for 7 years, and then it would go back to Universal. We want the film's rights in perpetuity forever. They're ours. They had to agree. They had to agree. Mm-hmm. So Abbott and Costello came away with, it was almost the $5 million. You know what I mean? So that worked out in their favor. But the one condition Universal had is that Eddie Sherman's office, Abbott and Costello, had to write an apology saying we overreacted, da 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 da. And they didn't mind, you know, that while they were pocketing $1 million apiece. So, yeah, I don't mind. I'm wiping my eyes with this, you know, $1,000 bill. So anyway, that was the big story. And this all happened before Lost in Alaska. So, Somebody on Facebook said, I love in the movie when Bud actually says, we're lost in Alaska. And he does. They suggested he should do it in every movie. We're lost in an army camp. We're lost in the Air Force. I think it would be a good thing. He'd be known for it, you know. But anyway. Let's talk about the players, as we always do.
Okay.
Let's talk about Gene Yarborough. Gene Yarborough, born in 1900, lived 74 years. He died in 1975, actually. And he was from Marianna, Arkansas. I never imagined Gene Yarborough being from Arkansas. You know, did he wear shoes? Oh, we're going to get mail on that one. Oh, boy. Anyway, he went to the University of the South. That's what it was called, the University of the South. It was in Suwanee, Tennessee. Suwanee. I always, when I drive out of Florida and I drive north out of Florida, I always cross the Suwanee River. And it's not spelled like it is in the song. It's Suwanee. It's an Indian name or a Native American name. Okay, so at 22, he went into silent films as a prop man. He became an assistant director. And then finally in 1936, he started directing like shorts, musical shorts and comedy shorts at RKO. And in 1938, for Progressive Productions, he did a movie. It was sort of an exploitation film called Rebellious Daughters. That was in 1938. But since then, he became a favorite of Abbott and Costello, director-wise. He was the king of pacing. I don't know what happened in this movie, but he was the king of pacing. And I'm talking Here Come the Coeds, In Society, Jack and the Beanstalk, The Naughty 90s. All of them move like lightning. This one's sort of like the lump they left behind. He did 5 Bowery Boys movies, some of my favorites, Angels in Disguise, Masterminds, which is one of the best horror comedies, really, of all time. Glenn Strange gives a performance. Had I been voting, he would have gotten an Oscar. Masterminds, Triple Trouble, when they go to prison. And then Leo's last one, Crashing Las Vegas, which is the one where he's drunk from the first scene all the way to the end. And it's very sad. And then one of the last with Stanley Clements called Hot Shots, which is actually a good one. He also directed one of my favorite Bela Lugosi movies, The Devil Bat. He did King of the Zombies. He did House of Horrors with Rondo Hatton. Rondo Hatton, my favorite line of dialogue. Martin Skoslick, who plays like the guy who takes him in. He's a murderer, Rondo Hatton. Mm-hmm. And he puts down dinner and he looks down and he goes, no meat. And I'll do that. When somebody puts out a plate of vegetables, I'll say, no meat. And they know exactly where it's from. The name of the movie, even the time code where it shows up. So anyway. So we're still talking about Gene, and he also directed oodles of television, including all of the Abbott and Costello Show episodes, also produced, and, you know, the Addams Family. His last movie starred Basil Rathbone and Lon Chaney Jr. in Hillbillies in a Haunted House, which I have on DVD. And it's poor Basil Rathbone. Just poor Basil Rathbone. He married a woman who loved to spend his money. And he had to make movies like Hillbillies and Haunted House in order to survive. So there you go. He was always short of money, it seemed. No wonder he was so good with the sword. He was good at cutting costs. So, I'm sorry. I really am. So, do you know that, what's his name? Ullman and Ed Burns, and we talked about what the hell's his name?
Elwood.
Elwood. But that's Harvey. Elwood Ullman and Ed Burns. They made a Bowery Boys movie called High Society. The same year, MGM made a movie with Bing Crosby, Frank Sinatra, and Grace Kelly in High Society. They made a mistake and sent Ed Burns and Elwood Ullman the Oscar nomination. They got to keep the letter. They framed it and kept it in their office. But they had to, of course, say, you know, I think you have the wrong High Society. But that's a funny story. So anyway, those are the people behind the scenes. And like we said, their new radio writers were responsible for this. And they wrote some really wonderful, a couple of really wonderful original routines for the boys. And we'll get to them as we get to them. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's start with the movie, and again, we will talk about the people as they come into the story. Yep. We open with a swing tune. Now, Jerry, tell me if you noticed anything, because I looked, you know, twice, actually. I watched this movie twice during this week, and so you see the medal I'm wearing? And oh, my goodness. And the music, I like the two songs that Mitzi Green sings. Okay, especially the one she does with Lou. And that's the music for the opening titles, right? And it's a swing song, and it's really a lot of fun, great orchestration. Who wrote it? There's no credits. There's no music credits. Who wrote those two songs? So that's right away, it's sloppy. I want to know who wrote those songs. So I don't know. I really don't know. I'd have to go into the Universal, you know, backlog and see what they have written down. A little weird. I do like that the film starts right away. There's almost no preamble, you know? There's Lou seeing Tom Ewell about to commit suicide by jumping into the water off the docks. This is San Francisco, like turn of the century. It is a period picture, actually.
Yeah.
And Lou belongs to the scouts, and he has to do a good deed every day. So he goes to save Tom Ewell, who has already jumped into the river. Bud is following him. What are you doing? And Lou decides to jump into the water and help him. Now, this is, to me, right off the top, this is one of the funniest scenes in the movie. Lou jumps up. This is a beautiful swan dive off the docks. And you hear, and he dove right into a boat, a rowboat, breaking the seat with his head. And Bud, of course, what are you doing? What are you jumping in the boat for? So Lou gets up, and this is what I found really funny. He gets up and he starts rowing the boat, but he forgets to untie it, and it breaks in half, and of course, he falls into the water. And I'm thinking back to, untie the boat, will you please? From Abner Costello Meets Frankenstein. Does he have a thing about untying boats? He's just not good. So Lou goes down, you know, with the boat. And in the meantime, you know, Bud is helping Tom Ewell, you know, as they're trying to get him up the ladder. And he's just too heavy. And Lou keeps saying, he's too heavy. I can't believe it. This I found very funny. They wanted to put across the point that he had gold in his pockets. So Lou is dubbed saying, he's got gold in his pockets. He says it like 15 times. So we know he has gold in his pockets. And that's why he's sinking. So Lou takes it over, puts it in his pants as Yule is lifted up by Abbott. And his suspenders are holding... I can't explain this. He's up at the top of the ladder, but his pants are down in the water, and his suspenders are stretched about 20 feet. So he's got the gold in his pants, and it's pulling him down, you know? So Bud has to pull him up, and they find the gold, and Bud sees the gold, and it's like his new religion. And, you know, he's just so... He's so greedy. You know, he saved the gold. He didn't save Tom Yule. So Tom Yule. Let's talk about Tom Yule. First of all, he's committing suicide because he's in love with a woman named Rosette, and she doesn't want him, and he just wants to die. He also has the richest gold mine in Alaska. Alaska. So Bud can't understand why he wants to kill himself, you know, blah, blah, blah. So Tom Yule, fascinating guy, and he... gained the respect. Now I could say Lou. Lou talked to him ahead of time, knowing that he was a Broadway actor and a trained actor. He went to the actor studio. And Lou wanted to make sure that he knew what he was getting into, basically. We work a certain way. You're going to have to, you know, leave behind what you learned and just kind of go with us and listen, you know, for anything that sounds like a cue, you jump in. So that's how they worked. Mitzi Green yep. said the same thing, but I'll tell you, Mitzi Green, I'll tell you about that when I get to it. Yeah, so Tom went ahead with it, and it took him about 3 days, and then he had the time of his life. He loved working with Abbott and Costello. He didn't love the script, didn't love the movie, but he loved working with Abbott and Costello. Born in 1909 in one of my favorite towns, great, great comedy town, Owensboro, Kentucky. I know that sounds weird, but it's true. A great, great town, laughing town. He went against his family wishes and went into the theater. His real name was Samuel Yule, Y-E-W-E-L-L, Tompkins. So why not Sam Tompkins? My name is Sam Tompkins. That's easy.
Yeah.
But anyway, in 1928, he went into summer stock with Donna Meachie. They made their debuts together. How about that? In 1931, he went to New York, studied at the Actors Studio. He got his first Broadway show in 1934 and stayed on and off Broadway constantly for the next 20, 25 years.
Wow.
Making movies in between. He made his film debut in 1940, but it was uncredited, and he did really small roles for a while. Then he went away to World War II. He was a lieutenant in the Navy. And when he got out, he started really his movie career in, he started it. And it was a 60-year career he had. So he came in, he started making movies. His big break was Adam's Rib in 1949. He and Judy Holliday were like the secondary couple behind Spencer Tracy and Katharine Hepburn. He went to Broadway, back to Broadway from 1953 to 1955. He played Richard Sherman in The 7-Year Itch. He won the Tony. He won the Golden Globe. And it was, that was it. His career exploded. And you'll notice it was 1953, a year after Lost in Alaska. So he was not the huge star that he became. He did The Girl Can't Help It with Edmund O'Brien and Jane Mansfield. And about 90 rock and roll acts. Do you like that movie, Jerry?
Yeah, I do. I do. I enjoy it tremendously. I always like Tom Yule, whatever he's doing. But yes, that one in particular.
Me too. Me too. Did you ever see his earlier movies based on, they were Willie and Joe. They were army buddies, and they fought in World War II. And it was called Upfront, Willie and Joe Upfront. And they made a few sequels. Ernie Pyle, I think, came up with these characters in his writing. And it became a small series at Universal. And that was really where critics and everything took notice of him. So anyway, he does that. He does a really historic theatrical production at the Coconut Grove Playhouse in Miami, Florida. It was Waiting for Godot, the premiere, the American premiere with Burt Lahr and Tom Yule. That would have been something, huh?
Yeah.
Totally forgot about that. I read about it last night. He had the Tom Yule Show for one season, a sitcom in 1961. He was in the remake of State Fair, the third remake. First was Will Rogers. The second one was, I think, Charles Wininger. And then this one was him and the return of Alice Faye after being retired from pictures for almost 20 years. It was a terrible movie. And let's see, he won an Emmy for Beretta. He did an episode. I think he played his father or something. And his last job was on an episode of Murder, She Wrote. And he passed away in 1994 at the age of 85. And Jerry and I both love Tom Yule.
Yes.
So, yeah. I know I have a quote from him that I want to read because Lou does twice. He does the laugh into crying in this movie. He does a long version and a very short version. But this is Tom Yule. Tom Yule remembers the production as a wonderful experience. While Tom didn't like the script, he enjoyed the experience of working with Bud and Lou. He said, "My overall impression was that Lou was a mischief-loving imp inside of a man's body. He was one of the nicest people I ever met. He loved to laugh, and he loved for everyone else to laugh. Most comedians just want the other people to laugh, but he really enjoyed the joke. He had a wonderful sense of humor. They also had three or four people in kind of a retinue. Everybody in those days had retinues. But the people he had were all practical jokers, and they'd keep the set at an uproar of laughter by playing pranks on people and visitors. But they were never mean. That's the one thing about Lou. You see, comedy can be very cruel at times. I know comedians can be cruel and take cracks at people. Lou's comedy was a sweet comedy. There was never anybody hurt in it. He got his laughs in a very wonderful, nice way. And I think that's one of the things that I can honestly say I admired about him. He never did anything to poke fun at anyone. Now, he'd poke fun at people on the set, between scenes. He'd do anything for a laugh. But that was to keep things up. The set was in a constant uproar, and the grips loved him, of course, because there was always something going on." So he also mentioned the laugh into crying, and I wanted to read that too. He also said that Lou, "I remember one thing that he did that impressed me, especially in this scene. He was really a brilliant actor. He had one moment that I'll never forget. I've never seen anybody else do it. He could start to laugh, then something would happen, and he'd go right from laughter to tears. It was a wonderful moment, and I've never known anybody in the world who could do it." How about that? I love that. It was a mutual respect, a mutual appreciation society, and I just love that.
Yeah.
So, nice. Tom, isn't that nice? I wanted to get that out there so you know at least there are some good things in this movie. I'm being real hard on it. But, so Tom Yule's character, Nugget Joe, he owns the richest mine in Alaska, and he's in love with a lady by the name of Rosette. So he's suicidal because Rosette doesn't want him. Bud can't understand. How can you? You've got this gold. How can you want to kill yourself? So they have to watch him. He goes to sleep. They put him in their bed, and Bud comes up with the idea that they would take 2-hour shifts. Okay, so of course Bud gets the first sleeping shift, and Lou has to stay up. And Lou is exhausted already, but he has to stay up for 2 hours. So we see the clock go 2 hours, and then he wakes up Bud. So Bud gets out of bed. Lou gets into bed and falls asleep immediately, and Bud goes over to the clock and moves it ahead 2 hours and goes over and wakes up Lou after he slept for about 30 seconds. So Lou has to get up and do his 2-hour shift while Bud gets 2 more hours of sleep. And again, the clock goes around, and Lou goes over, wakes up Bud, and Bud does the same thing. He turns the clock ahead, and poor Lou is like, "Boy, it's amazing what a little sleep will do. I feel so refreshed." I love that he's wearing his long johns through this whole scene. He looks like a little ball. Yep. So this goes on, and it really is a clever routine. And there's a whole thing with the numbers and, "Well, take 5 and 4, and it's 9 o'clock, see?" You know, he looks out the window at one point, and it's still dark, and it says 8 o'clock in the morning. Why is it still dark? But anyway, it's a funny routine. It's cruel. I find it very cruel for Abbott and Costello.
Yep.
Let's talk about Bud in this movie, okay? Just off the beaten track here. Bud has never been more cruel He's never been more horrible than he's been in this movie, than he is in this movie. He just does nothing but yell at Lou, push him into horrible situations, keep him from sleep. And I don't sleep, so this really hit me. He's just horrible. He's absolutely horrible. And as I'm watching them, I'm thinking to myself, I always compare them to Laurel and Hardy. I always think to myself, their partnership was so much closer than Abbott and Costello. With Abbott and Costello, it's starting to seem like it's Lou with Bud just sort of like pushing him along. But he's not really contributing as much as he used to in the old movies when he was doing the crosstalk, right? Now it's sort of like situational. It's all situational. So what do you think about that, Jared? Am I right about that, about Bud?
Oh, I agree. Yes, he does come across much more mean and selfish in this one. I mean, you know, we mentioned last episode in Jack and the Beanstalk when they're making their escape and he's got his hen that lays the golden eggs and he's got his bag of jewels and he's making his way and he turns around and looks to see if Lou is coming and then just kind of, nah, never mind him, and keeps running, you know?
It's even that. It says the hell with him, you know? That
yes,
gesture. And
but
that's
even
something that Laurel and Hardy would never do.
Yes. And that bit is not as mean as he can be in this movie.
He's disgusting in this movie. I'm sorry, but he is just absolutely horrible. I was watching it on my computer. I'm staying with some people, my cousins, in Warwick, New York. And I'm up on the top floor in a guest bedroom, and it's lovely. But I was afraid they were going to hear Bud screaming at Lou. But they sleep on the same floor, my cousins. And I kept turning down the volume. What are you doing? He's like King Kong in this movie. You know, it's ridiculous. And I don't know, how did he allow that? I think he enjoyed it. I really think he enjoyed being that character because he does it so much. So who knows? Yeah. You know, Lou was about being lovable and cute and all that stuff. Bud was the opposite. So he stayed with his burlesque character his entire career. But it's a little uncomfortable in this movie. I'm sorry, but it is.
It is.
Okay, so they go over the thing and they realize that they want to send Tom Yule back to Alaska, back to Skagway, where I've been, by the way, and twice. And he wants to get back to Rosette because she sent a letter saying, it's all good, come back. I want you back. So he's all excited. And the boat, there's only one boat going that month, and it's leaving in like an hour. So he gets ready and he goes, and Bud and Lou see him off. But then they see the newspaper, and they're being accused of killing Nugget Joe because he's disappeared. And they said there were two firemen. I forgot to mention they were firemen. That they saw two firemen by the docks pushing him in the water. So they accused them of murdering Nugget Joe. So they go to the ship and get on the ship with Nugget Joe and say, you've got to come with us. You've got to go to the sheriff's office and say you're alive and that we're not murderers because they're going to kill us. They're going to hang us. So anyway, this is where Lou does his laughing into crying. Can you imagine they're looking at you as murderers? And then Bud says, they're going to hang us. And it slowly turns into crying. And no matter how many times you see it, it's still impressive and it's still funny.
Oh, yeah. I'm
sorry.
Oh, yes. Just... Every time.
I think
every
of it, time. I laugh. Yeah, yeah. A specialty, a definite specialty. And then when they try to explain to him, the ship whistle is cutting them off. He can't hear what they're saying. And eventually they're all taking off together. So they're on their way to be lost in Alaska. So they get to Skagway and we realize that this is what sold. Who was it? That one of the background people loved the idea. Oh, the writer, that Martin Ragaway and Leonard Stern loved the idea from the story that this was the most hated person in the world and everybody wanted to kill him. So let me explain. Tom Yule's character, Nugget Joe, was the sheriff for about like 2 years or a year, something like a year. And unfortunately, during that time, he had to hang about 48 people during that year. And all their relatives now want to kill him. So he can't walk on the streets without being shot at. And I want to just mention that these are the worst shots in the world. It's like they got the Home for the Blind and said, here's some guns, shoot. Horrible, just horrible. And they were like 2 feet from them shooting, and nobody gets killed.
Yep.
But anyway, everybody wants to kill him. Even people that, you know what, he's such a decent man. He thought, he put in his will, all the old timers, he calls them the old timers. These were the old prospectors that he would, you know, shoulder to shoulder, you know, working up there and trying to find the gold. And so because he was so lucky, he made out a will leaving his $2 million to all the old timers. But what do? They want to kill him so they can collect on the will. So this is the thing. This is the contrivance in Lost in Alaska and what they're dealing with, Bud and Lou. So they go to Jake Stillman's saloon, and Jake Stillman is the great villain, Bruce Cabot.
Yes.
And yeah, and Bruce Cabot was, well, we'll get to him. Let's get to him later. Let's talk about Missy Green first. Missy Green is Rosette, the love of Nugget Joe's life. We walk in just as she's doing an opening number. And I believe, what is it called? It's like, I'm an old-fashioned gal. I think that was called. I'm an old-fashioned gal. And it's all about how she's not an old-fashioned gal, of course. And she does, Mitzi Green was known for her impersonations. When she was 8, 9 years old, whatever, 7, 8, 9 years old, she was doing impersonations of the old actor George Arliss and creating his face as well. Maurice Chevalier, which was her favorite of the bunch, Edna Mae Oliver, Roscoe Ates, Charlie Mack from Mack and Moran. It was a blackface act. That's why they're forgotten today. Okay, she was born Elizabeth Keno, K-E-N-O, to vaudevillians. She was born in the Bronx in 1920. She joined the act at the age of 3. She went to where she was called Little Mitzi. My friend Steve Thompson, by the way, in the magazine Classics of the Golden Age, I think it's called, a horrible name. But his article on Missy Green is terrific. I read it this morning. It actually took me almost a half hour to get through it. It's that detailed, but wow. Wonderful stuff. Thank you, Steve, for that. But anyway, she started at 3. Paramount signed her in 1929 when she was 9 years old. And she made Tom Sawyer there with Jackie Coogan. She did Huckleberry Finn. She was in Paramount on Parade, the big all-star, you know, Paramount musical, imitating Maurice Chevalier, in fact. And she was in Love Among the Millionaires with Clara Bow, just a lot of movies from Paramount. She was in a great movie called Finn and Hattie with Zazu Pitts and Leon Errol. And that one's on YouTube, I believe. I think I saw it recently. Yeah. And another one I saw, she went to RKO. Paramount let her go when she started growing up a little bit. But she went to RKO and she made a movie called Little Orphan Annie, where she played Annie. And this was 1932. Now, they tried to get as many impersonations in her movies because they were so miraculous. She does scenes from Horse Feathers, which was a Paramount movie. This is an RKO movie. She's doing Groucho's dialogue from Horse Feathers. And Chico, she does Harpo. She's amazing. She's just an amazing little girl. And she could sing like an adult, like Baby Rosemary. She could sing like an adult. So she did that. And then she did Girl Crazy, based on the Broadway show, the big Gershwin Broadway show that introduced Ethel Merman and Ginger Rogers. But neither one of them were in the movie. And they cut out most of the songs. But she gets to do... they're writing songs of love, but not for me. And she does 4 different imitations, 4 people singing that song. And it's Roscoe Ates, George Arliss. Oh, boy, I can't remember the other two. But anyway, it's my favorite scene in the movie. And Wheeler and Woolsey are the stars. They remade the movie. They remade the script to make it a Wheeler and Woolsey movie. A lot of people don't like it. I really do. I think it's a very good movie. It's a funny Wheeler and Woolsey movie.
Yes.
They made some bad decisions, but it's basically okay. So anyway, she made her last movie as a child when she was 14 years old. It was a independent movie, Edward Small, Transatlantic Merry-Go-Round. And it's on YouTube, and it stars Jack Benny and a whole bunch of other people, including the Boswell sisters, who do a song called Rock and Roll. Anyway, I saw this in the movies in New York, and it was a lot of fun. But no offers came after that. Nobody wanted an in-betweener, I guess. But she never stopped working. She did what was left of vaudeville, made good money. You know, her parents worked her. Let me put it that way. The father was more of a stage mother than the mother. Anyway, in 1937, a big thing happened for her. The Rodgers and Hart hit Babes in Arms opened on Broadway. And she was a major part of it. She did My Funny Valentine. She did Lady is a Tramp. I forget the third one, another standard, you know. And it brought her back. It got her notice again. But it wasn't movies. And she wanted to go back to Hollywood more than anything. She loved Hollywood. Mm. But it was nightclubs, you know, mostly nightclubs, presentation houses. And then eventually she got a chance to go into movies. And she said no. She suddenly developed stage fright. She was away so long from the cameras that she couldn't do it. So she continued appearing in nightclubs. She married an actor, director, Joseph Pevney, who directed a lot of the shows we watched on television as kids, among other things, and was very happy. She had children, you know. She loved being home. So she decided, I better give movies another try. And that was this movie. And she says, and I'm sort of paraphrasing, but she said it was the perfect movie to start again. There were no rehearsals. There were very few takes. It was very, very loose. So it was the perfect thing for her. But she only made one more movie after that. It was called Bloodhounds on Broadway, 20th Century Fox. Mitzi Gaynor was the star, and she was the co-star, Mitzi Green. So they called Mitzi Gaynor Mitzi Jr., and they called her Mitzi Sr. So, and apparently it's a good movie. I've never seen it, but I'm going to look for it now. And believe it or not, she had a sitcom. It only lasted one season because it was up against the Jackie Gleason show. This was 1955, and it was called So This is Hollywood, and she played a stunt woman. And getting into all kinds of crazy situations and whatever. I saw one, I might be on YouTube. So This is Hollywood, and it's with Virginia Gibson and our buddy, Mike the Cop, Gordon Jones, was a supporting character. And it's not bad. It really isn't bad. It had a short life on reruns, and she liked it because she got to stay home, you know, with her family. But then it was back to summer stock and nightclubs, and, you know, she did well. She got top dollar, but, you know, she wanted to be home. Unfortunately, she developed cancer at a very young age, and she passed away at the age of 48. 48, that bundle of talent. Mm. She was the most talented female star, I think, child star ever, more than Shirley Temple, more than any of them. She was almost like an adult. It was an amazing, amazing thing. So anyway, she's working at Bruce Cabot's place. Jake Stillman is his name. He's our villain. I love the way it's all wrapped up at the end, by the way. I'm going to say that now. But Bruce Cabot was born in 1904. His real name, are you ready? Do you have an hour? Etienne Pelissier Jacques de Boujac. Did you get that?
Wow.
Yeah. You need a bookmark, you know, to write his name now. He was born in the Carlsbad Territory of New Mexico. That sounds mysterious. And coincidentally, he went to the University of the South, the same one Gene Yarborough went to. What are the chances? And I think they were there around the same time, right? But he did not graduate. He did not stay long enough to graduate. He had every job in the world, including working in a slaughterhouse, which again, I never understood how anyone could work in a slaughterhouse and in their right minds. And it just makes me realize, yeah, no wonder he was a villain. You know, he was able to do that. and somehow, during all of these jobs, he ended up in Hollywood. And he went to a party one night, and he went up right up to David Selznick, David O. Selznick, one of the big wigs at RKO at the time. And he got him alone in a room, and he did a scene from the Broadway play Chicago for him. And later on, he said, I was absolutely awful, but I ended up in a movie. So he started his career. with a party audition, and ended up doing his first movie in 1932. It was called The Roadhouse Murder. And that led to 1933, where he made what I think is one of the top three movies of all time, and that is King Kong. Yep. He was the hero.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I was very confused by the fact that he started out as a hero, but he really drifted into villainous roles, and he became pegged as a villain. So, yep. I mean, he made a few movies here and there, mostly B-movies where he was the hero, but not many, not many. He was great in a movie called Let 'Em Have It. He was a horrible gangster in that. He was the villainous Native American in Last of the Mohicans with Randolph Scott. In Fury with Spencer Tracy, 1936, he mm-hmm. was the head of the lynch mob. And here's something. In 1939, he made one of my favorite westerns. And it was called Dodge City with Errol Flynn and Olivia de Havilland. And he's the villain in that. But that's what started his, I don't want to say his affair, his friendship with Errol Flynn. They were very close, went with the same circles, drank themselves into imbecility. But this is what fascinated me, is the fact that he was up for the Ringo Kid in Stagecoach before John Wayne got it. Isn't that something? It would have been a different movie, boy. It would have been a different movie, and John Wayne would have continued, you know, toiling in B-Westerns for the rest of his life. So he went into the Army Air Force during World War II. He was stationed in Tunis, where he got some tuna sandwiches. And in 1947, he did Angel and the Bad Man with John Wayne and Gail Russell, and he became part of John Wayne's inner circle and ended up making 11 movies with John Wayne. Right up to the end in the 1970s. Yeah, yeah. John Wayne kind of took care of him because nobody liked him. He was a rat. And I'll tell you a quick story. He was really best friends with Errol Flynn. The two of them kind of looked out for each other and all that. Errol Flynn was completely broke, went to England because he got a chance to produce and star in a film, The William Tell, William Tell Story. And Bruce Cabot was also broke and needed work. So Errol Flynn flew him out on the producer's dime and put him in the movie. I'm sure he was the villain. And the money ran out. So instead of standing by his friend, he immediately went into action and sued him and then left him high and dry. Went back to the States, said, screw you, you know, these are your problems. And that was it. They never spoke again. So that's Bruce Cabot. What a wonderful fellow he was. They both show up. Errol Flynn and Bruce Cabot both show up in an episode of the Colgate Comedy Hour with Abbott and Costello, the Western story, you know, where they're going to the dude ranch or whatever. And Errol Flynn does Slowly I Turned with Lou. And Bruce Cabot does I Don't Care for Nothing, you know, turkey sandwich and a cup of coffee. But no twins, nothing like that. And he's barely in it. It's like they gave him work, definitely. And that's really all he did. But it was interesting to see the two of them on live television and working with the boys. His last movie, it was a one you may have heard of. It's called Diamonds Are Forever. And he did some TV work. And he had three wives, one of which I'm very jealous. One of the most beautiful women from the 1930s, and her name was Adrienne Ames. And if you want to look her up, guys, it's worth it. She is just gorgeous. And he passed away a year after Diamonds Are Forever in 1972. So Bruce Cabot was not forever. So yeah, there we have it. We have our main players, and I have a few more coming up, but we're going to see this. So here's what happens. Tom Yule is watching his girl, Rosette, sing this song, and he's just head over heels in love. And she starts flirting with another guy. Another guy pulls her onto his lap, and he goes crazy. And Bruce Cabot steps in and says, no, no, don't hurt yourself. Come on, drinks are on. He's so friendly, so friendly. So he calls Rosette. He calls Mitzi Green into his office, and Mitzi Green is on to him and says, you sent that letter to him to get him back here. Why do you want him back here? And he says, here's my plan. He's got $2 million in gold. If he marries you, you are the only heir. I'll kill him, and then you and I will get married, and we'll share the money. And she says, great idea. Okay, you're on. And right away, I'm thinking, what is this movie? What is this movie? I don't get it. I really don't get it. So anyway, it turns out that she double crosses Bruce Cabot. And so they have to go to the mine. They have to go to his mine and try to hide what they have there, so nobody can get there and steal it from him. And Stillman actually is right behind them in their dog sled. Now, there are still the old timers after them, still coming after them. They want to kill him, Tom Yule. And now Stillman is suspecting a double cross. And he and his boys, one of which is Lou's brother-in-law, Joe Kirk, Mr. Bacigalupo. And so they follow along. They follow along to see where they go, and they just know they're going to go to the mine, you know. So they have to go to – there's one gag I want to go back and just mention because I think it's really clever and cute.
Okay.
Bud at one point leaves Lou to – by the way, their names are Tom and George. This gives you an idea of the creativity in this movie. So Bud has to leave him alone with what's his name. And he says, when he comes back, Bud says, where's Nugget Joe? And he says, oh, he's in the bathroom shaving. And Bud's like, shaving? Are you kidding? You gave him a razor? He's suicidal, you know? So Lou opens the door and the mirror is broken. And the only part that's broken is his head, where his head would be. So Lou takes a look at him, missing his head, and does one of the funniest feints I've ever seen. He looks at the camera, his eyes cross, and he just falls back, you know, stiff as a board. And it's very funny. And so clever. You know what I mean? He thought he cut his head off. So, like I said, Rosette turns on Bruce Cabot. She's helping them out. He thinks she's in love with him again. So he's a happy guy. And so they have to hire a lawyer. I know I'm going back on this because I'm, you know, again, I'm not, even though I've watched it twice, I'm not that familiar with this movie.
Yeah.
So they need a lawyer. And they go into the, you know, Stillman Saloon, which has gambling. This, to me, is the most clever routine in the movie. And this is the roulette scene. So yep. Lou has to interview this lawyer to make sure he's the one they want, you know, for their job. The last one they went to was actually one of the old timers, and he would have killed them, you know. So he goes to this guy. This guy was just there for a year now. There's no way he was an old timer. So Lou takes out his pad, his little pad, and he starts asking questions, but he numbers them. So the roulette guy is like, okay, what do you want? Lou gives him a quarter. He gets one chip, and he just kind of throws it down, and he wins, okay. So the roulette guy is like, you know, well, what do you want next? And Lou is looking down his list and he goes, number two, are you a person we can trust? And da, 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 da. So the guy hears number two and he puts the chips on number two and he wins. So Lou is already on number four and he goes, what number do you want? And he goes, number four. Now your office, is it in a safe place? And da, 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 da. They put it on number four and he wins. The thing is piling up. Till they get to the point where it's $40,000 and they empty all the chips onto the table. All the croupiers are sweating. And finally he says one more number and he loses. Okay. So they take all the chips away. And when he's done with the interview, Bud comes up and says, what did he win? And he goes, no, he lost. So but Lou looks at him and goes, so what? I lost my last dollar. What are you going to do? He had no idea that he won anything. It really is clever. But I will tell you, mm-hmm. the behind the scenes, the writers, when they saw the routine on film, thought they undersold it. They thought it could have been much funnier because they had other ideas, but they simplified it while they were shooting it. And that's one of the things that Lou apologized for when he got together with Leonard Stern. But it's funny as it is. I mean, they repeated on their television show. So they use that to change the will. But unfortunately, as they're walking down the street with this lawyer, ready to change the will and do what they have to do, the old timers off screen drop a rope from above and pull the lawyer up. So the lawyer just kind of flies out of the picture, and Budden turn around and he's gone, and they can't find him, and that's that. So much for that.
We never see the lawyer again. It just makes me wonder, what the heck happened to that guy?
You talk about, you know, high lawyer fees. he was pretty high. So here's what they have to do. During this time with the roping the lawyer, he does the laughing into crying, but it's really short. But I can't believe they let him do it again. This is this movie. It's like nobody cared, basically. So anyway, now they have to go with the Nugget Joe. They have to follow him to the mine where they have to hide everything before everyone gets there, blah, blah, blah. So they're all going to meet at the Muckaluck Village. And that's not a restaurant. It's a place where Eskimos live. And it's almost like when, you know, the cowboys would be riding down the plains and they'd stop at an Indian reservation and spend the night in a teepee, you know, all of that. So this is the place they're going. But Bud and Lou have to find their own dogs for the sled. And Lou at one point says,
"Let's go up north."
"Why?
That's where the pole is."
"So what?
Dogs like cold weather."
"Oh, yes, yes. Come on."
So they clean that up pretty well, but they do the same joke. They do the same joke later. Let's look for a tree. You know, where are we going to find the dogs? Let's look for a tree. Same thing, you know, and Lou's kind of winking at us. But okay, so cheap gags. And while Bud at one point, "I'm going to go find a dog," he runs off and he leaves Lou, who finds a crate full of crabs, live crabs ready to be seafood, you know. And he opens it up and the crab arm comes out and bites his nose and all this stuff. And I'm sorry, it's lame. The whole thing is lame. It doesn't look like a crab leg. It just doesn't work.
It gave me the impression that they were trying to recreate the oyster stew or the frog in the soup from Wistful Widow. And it just doesn't work.
Mm-mm. It's lame.
There's exceptionally so. You know, the crab claw is about 3 feet long. That would have to be one humongous crab.
And we didn't see any humongous crabs in there because we get to look inside. And then Bud comes. "What are you, afraid of crabs? What are you, nuts? I'm not afraid of crabs." And they see this crab walking towards them in the snow. And Bud gets scared, and he runs out, and Lou sees it, and they run out of the picture. They didn't even, like, bother to show maybe that it was bigger than a regular crab, that it was like a monster they saw to create that, you know, that fear. It just doesn't work. It doesn't work at all.
No.
So anyway, they find a row of dogs, and there's another kind of risky joke there where – Bud asks about the dogs.
"I don't know if I'm doing right getting into this sleigh."
"What are you talking about? This is the fastest dog team in the whole world."
"What do you mean?"
"I get a load of all my dogs. See the first dog?
Yeah.
That's Butch. Then there's George. Then there's Albert. Then there's Gene. Then there's Joe."
"What makes them so fast?"
"You see the lead dog?"
"Yes.
Her name is Gloria."
"Oh, come on. Let's get going.
How do you work this?"
So that's the joke. They're all running after the woman. Again, you know, it's like... At one point, they do one thing that I like is that when they're looking for the dogs and the dog jumps into that window and Lou puts his hands in and says, "Wait, there's two dogs. I've got their tails." It turns out to be a woman with pigtails screaming for dear life. That's clever. So, okay. The dogs are there. They're a little undisciplined. They're heading for a tiny hole in the fence. And Bud and Lou are already attached to the sled. So they have to go through the fence. And then all of a sudden they go through a flour mill, okay? They go into a place that manufactures flour. And when they go in, there's a big white explosion of flour. Now, this is the other thing I found clever, is that they were completely white. And once they got to the other end, they were in complete white snow, white backgrounds, white mountains, and you couldn't see them. You just heard the voices because they were white.
Yes.
And they blended in. So I thought that was very clever. And slowly that wore off. And they were superimposed into that, by the way, which I thought was unusual. But Ed Wood, remember Ed Wood? Plan 9 from Outer Space, Bride of the Monster. Yeah. He worked on this movie. He was a, I think he was like a production assistant is what he called himself. And he was so impressed by the untoasted cornflakes that they shipped in. I mean, like a ton to take the place of snow. He talked about it till the day he died. He was so impressed. You should have seen what they did with this movie and da da. And then he'd go to do his movies, you know, and he'd use like a bicycle horn for a special effect. So anyway, they've got their sled dogs. They lose them and they have to walk. And that's when Bud says, don't you realize we're lost in Alaska? When I went to Alaska, that's all I said, by the way. Nobody wanted to hang around with me. So they get to an incline. They have to go up. He makes Lou pull while Bud pretends to push. And they get to the end, this precipice. And of course, Lou doesn't see it. And I really like this effect. I thought it looked great. He's hanging from mm-hmm. the end of the sled over this like 1,000-foot drop. And he's superimposed, of course, but it looks real. It really looks, yeah. terrific. Yeah, it was a nice effect. And I'm sure they spent a lot of money, a lot of the budget on that. And it became a Lou scare thing, you know, no, pull me back. And Bud doesn't know what he's doing. He's pushing him back and whatever. So they have their own spot where they have fishing holes. You know, Bud has a hole here that he's fishing in. They have their backs to each other. Lou has his side. And Lou sees a seal. And he says, hey, there's a dog down there. What's a dog doing down there? And I like when he imitates the sound of the seal.
Yes.
But anyway, they do lame hunting jokes, which I'm sure the boys added.
Hey, Tom.
What?
Now, don't lie to me. Do you think we'll ever get back to San Francisco safe? Now, don't lie.
I don't know, George. It looks bad. They may find our bodies up here in the snow after the polar bears get through with us.
Tom.
What?
Go ahead. You can lie to me if you want.
It's nice to love bears. I remember when I used to go hunting bear in San Francisco. Did you ever go hunting bear?
Always had clothes on.
Well, you've got to have clothes on to hunt bear.
Well, if you hunt bear, how can you have clothes on?
You know what bears are? I'm talking about a bear. You go bear hunting, you go bear hunting. Yeah. You hunt bear.
Same thing. I used to go hunting for reindeer.
Reindeer?
Reindeer.
Did you ever hunt deer?
Yes, sweetheart.
Oh, stop. You're getting silly. Hey.
What I liked was their lines get tangled, and Lou pulls, and Bud goes into the hole. And has to come out the other side. Lou is pulling and he says, I got a jerk on my line, which I think is very funny. But he pulls Bud out, you know, hey, this fish looks just like you. So they end up freezing while they're walking. The two of them, they're just frozen. And one of the production assistants was quoted as saying that they were such troopers. This was summer. They were shooting in the summer. They were really hot under the lights. Yet they had those coats on, you know, and had to pretend to walk slowly. And it was hard. It wasn't easy. So real troopers. I like that. So they freeze and the Muckalucks, the Eskimos, come and take them after spouting the worst jokes I've ever heard in an Abbott and Costello movie. And they're dubbed, you know, these two guys. I didn't even quote it. I didn't even write it down. That's how bad this dialogue is. So they go to the Muckluck village, they thaw out, and Nugget Joe and Rosette are there already, and they know everybody there. They're very friendly. And the chief is my Sicilian buddy, Iron Eyes Cody. His real name was Espera Oscar De Corti. He was born in Louisiana, where a lot of Sicilians came over and lived and helped invent jazz, I want to say. The first original Dixieland jazz band were all Italians and Sicilians. He changed it to Cody. His parents owned a little grocery store in Louisiana. Ended up doing extra work with his two brothers. And he ended up making over 200 films. And you could, you know, really trace him to the litter commercial, where he's the Native American who he turns his head and you see the tear coming down. He was most famous for that. Mm-hmm. But he was great in, you know, Pale Face with Bob Hope and all the comedies where he played Native Americans. And I think I mentioned before, I sat next to him at Jimmy Durante's funeral. And very nice man. Very, very nice man. But it wasn't until he died that we found out he was Sicilian and not a Native American. he embraced the culture, and he told his sister, I believe it was, who was going to blow the whistle, and actually did in an article. He was very angry about it, and he denied it.
Mm.
So it wasn't until after he was dead that we realized this. His last movie, are you ready? Ernest Goes to Camp. 1987, right up to the end. Boy, oh boy. So Iron Eyes is there. He's the chief. And they do a scene here that I kind of like. They're eating whale meat, right? And Bud's just having an orgasm. He says, "This is delicious. Whale meat." And Lou, you know, does something that I still do when I put a fork into a fish or whatever it is. I say, "Harpoon." And I put the fork in. And that's what Lou does. He takes his fork, "Harpoon." And every time he cuts into it, water squirts into his face. I think I got the spout, which is exactly what he has. And he keeps getting hit in the face. And then finally he switches with Bud and, of course, looks over and the water squirts him again in the face from a different direction. So it's a nice punchline to a pretty funny scene. So this is where we're getting towards the end. The igloo melts because they have the fire going. And here's another thing that didn't work at all. They're leaving the Muckluck village, and there's a beautiful Eskimo woman waving goodbye. And Lou runs back and says, "I want to tell you a joke." And he leans in and he whispers in her ear, leans back, and she slaps him in the face. And he turns to us and he goes, "Guess it didn't work." And he walks out. What? We don't know what the joke was. Was it a dirty joke? Was it no idea. It's just, it seemed like nobody cared at this point. anyway. So everything ends up where they have the old timers at one side coming at them. They have Jake Stillman and his boys coming from the other end, and they have the $2 million wrapped up in the sled. And that's Tom Mule and Mitzi Green have that. So they leave them there to get the money away, and Bud and Lou have to hold down the fort. So what do? They just start taking dead fish and throwing them at the bad guys. And Lou sets up a thing with his suspenders where it's like a slingshot, and he's hitting them in the face with fish. And it's really silly. It's very silly. At one point, Lou takes a boomerang, and he goes, "Oh, I think I'll throw this coat hanger." And he throws it, and he turns around to walk away, and it comes back and hits him, and he falls, right? And it's kind of cute, you know. And he looks at it and says, "They have one too," which I thought was funny. But they get into something, Abbott and Costello, at this point. Lou uses the slingshot, but it hits Bud by accident. And Bud turns around and he throws a fish at Lou. And before you know it, the two of them are scrambling all over each other like two kids. They're fighting, you know, like two angry children. And it's very unusual. Bud never gets into situations like that, you know? It was very interesting to watch. But anyway, so blah, blah, blah. They're throwing things at each other. They're fighting things off. And what happens? The ice starts separating. Lou and the $2 million falls into the water. The $2 million is gone. Everybody meets on the ice thing, looking down and shaking their heads. Nobody cares about Lou, by the way. He's doing what he did in the beginning of the movie, holding up his fingers. You know, "I'm going down for the third time." What I liked is when he holds up the one finger, he's using the other hand to point to it to make sure that he's got their attention. It really is cute. It's a nice moment. But anyway, as they're talking, and by the way, there is another phony-looking bear. This one's a polar bear. I think it's the cousin of the one from Ride 'Em Cowboy and the 1990s. But all the villains and all the old-timers and everybody, all of a sudden everybody's friends. "You know what? I'm going to throw you the best wedding you've ever seen. Everything's going to be on the house. I'm going to pay for it." That's Stillman, the villain. Yep. So anyway, where's Lou? So they all pull him up, you know, and he's soaking wet and blah, blah, blah. And they all say, "Okay, come on, let's go. Let's go. We'll have the wedding." And they all walk off, right? Lou is left behind, and he has the boomerang in his hand, and he says, you're the cause of all this trouble." And he throws it away, and they cut to him getting hit again. He turns around, he gets hit, and he falls forward. The end. Now, two things about this ending. Number one, it's not the original. Here's what they did. The original idea was so much better. He throws the boomerang, and that's the end of the scene. You cut back to San Francisco, where they're back to their fireman jobs, they're back on the dock, and all of a sudden, the boomerang comes and hits Lou in the back of the head and knocks him into the water. That's an ending. Right,
Jerry?
But what did they do instead? They took a shot from the earlier fight. They reversed the film and changed it to a more of a close-up, but it's the same shot that they just repeated, and it's not funny.
Totally forgetting the fact that Lou has just been pulled out of the water. He is soaking wet when he throws the boomerang, and bone dry when it hits him.
Maybe they won't notice. You know, maybe they won't notice. Oh, God. I did want to mention one person before we finish up. And I know we're giving a lot of time to this movie, but I'm sorry. There was just a lot of stuff. Emery Parnell is the head of the old timers. He wants to kill them worse than any of them. And he's probably the worst shot of the bunch. But he's a wonderful actor. And he's been in so many movies. And he's just one of those perennials that I always spot. He was one of Preston Sturges' stock company. He shows up the beginning of a movie called Louisiana Purchase, based on an Irving Berlin show, in color, in Technicolor, 1941. He opens the movie as a lawyer. And before the titles, this is really unusual. And you know when you tell a story in a movie, but you precede it with all characters are based on fictional characters, blah, 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 blah. So you protect yourself, basically. He sings this. He sings the whole legalese, and he has a beautiful voice. And I had no idea that he was actually a singer as well.
Huh.
So he's born in 1892 in St. Paul, Minnesota. He actually dug for gold in Alaska as a young man. He was a telegrapher. He was a concert violinist, also played accordion and drums. He moved to Detroit to appear in industrial films, silent ones. Weird. He did a vaudeville act with his wife and traveled all over the world with it. And actually in the 1950s brought it back and toured all the army camps in Korea with his wife and his grandson. And they did this act up until the 1970s?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah. In many shorts, you see him in the Three Stooges. You see him with everybody. Lots of Bob Hope movies. He did one Broadway show. It lasted five performances called Mr. Adam in 1949. He shows up on Green Acres. He shows up on Petticoat Junction. He had a son who was an actor. You might want to look up James Parnell. But unfortunately, he was 38 when he died. And like I said, the family act went up to 1970. They did it. And it was a musical vaudeville act. So pretty cool. And he passed away in 1979 at the age of 86. So that's Emery Parnell for you hardcore people. So that's it. That's Lost in Alaska. I think it's one of their worst films. It has moments like all their films, but it just looks like something nobody cared about. You know, the little film no one cared about. Jerry, I want your assessment now.
Well, I think if it had come at a different point in the latter part of their career, let me clarify that a bit. The fact that we just watched Jack and the Beanstalk, which is a delightful film, a fun film, a family-friendly festival. Let's see how much alliteration I can do here.
I'm not counting.
And then to be followed by this, I think just points out how weak this film actually is.
And you know what? I partially blame the boys because, you know, it's kind of lackluster. Other than Bud. Bud is like on, you know, on 10 cylinders of horrible.
Yeah.
But it just seems like maybe the whole lawsuit thing and everything made them not want to cooperate as much or whatever. I don't know. What do you think?
Could be. Yeah. Could be. Mm-hmm. One element of this film that for some reason sticks in my brain as a little, why did he do that kind of a moment? Lou is wearing that derby. The derby from the Colgate show, the derby from their TV show, his burlesque hat, basically. You know, it's a half a size too small, and it's a comedy hat. Yes. And it just screams to me, we're trying to get laughs any way we can, so let's put on a funny hat.
You know, Matthew Conium, my co-author for the annotated Abbott and Costello, which is on sale right now at Amazon.
Yes.
And I mean on sale, not just for sale. Mm-hmm. But he says that he never liked the costume that Lou chose to wear towards the end of the Abbott and Costello. He wore that checkered coat with the pants and the little hat. And he loved the little hat. He just loved it. And that became the hat for the rest of his career. It shows up in a lot of their stuff. I really kind of thought it looked funny with the heavy coats. You know what I mean? Bud's wearing is putting the thing around his head, and he's really cold. And Lou's got this little hat on, you know. So I thought it was kind of cute. But I agree with you. It is a little, I don't want to say desperate, but it's a little, look how funny I am. I'm the funny man, you know, that kind of thing.
You know, I would go so far as to say if it only showed up in this movie, then yes, I would agree. It's a nice, you know, counterpoint to the parka and the humongous mittens and this little tiny derby, you know.
And tiny hat. Yeah, yeah. Okay. I can't say that I recommend watching this movie. I mean, I think it's – if you're going to be a completist and you want to go over chronologically, or if you want to, like, match it to what we're talking about and go see it for yourself – I just think, you know, what I used to think about Africa Screams, which I don't anymore. I changed my opinion. Mm-hmm. I think this may be their worst film. I really do. I was watching it last night and just shaking my head thinking there are so many wrong decisions made in this film. Comedy scenes that don't have a button and then it fades out anyway. You know, it's like, what were they thinking? What the hell were they thinking? So they were lost with Lost in Alaska. And I just can't, it's hard for me because I love these guys so much, but you got to call a spade and you got to be honest about it. This is not their shining hour. Let's put it that way.
Yep.
But their next film, I recommend. I certainly recommend. And it has one main reason to watch it, but although it's a good movie, I really think it's a good movie. My favorite actor ever, even now, is Charles Laughton. To me, there was no one better. Not Olivier, nobody was better than Charles Laughton in my estimation. He works with the boys in Abbott and Costello Meet Captain Kidd. And to see Charles Laughton doing slapstick comedy, even having a few lines in a song here and there, it's him doing British pantomime, basically. And it's just wonderful. So we'll look at that in 2 weeks. We'll record that one. In the meantime, Jerry, again, I can't stress enough how much I enjoy spending time with you, going over these movies, and in general. So I don't like to get military, but, you know, it's a lot of fun.
As long as you don't make a major statement like that in private, we should be okay.
Well, I can just say, Lieutenant. I don't know why, but it does go along with the military theme. I think I'm ready for my pill. So anyway, Lost in Alaska, go at your own risk. And when you're writing about it, I have a few people who write to me on a regular basis about the podcast and what we talk about. And I'm just waiting for the remarks on this one because a lot of people seem to agree with me on this one. So I'm sure I'm going to get a lot of that. And again, gang, if you're listening on YouTube and taking a free ride, please hit subscribe, please. It takes a half a second and press like, please. Okay, I'm going to wait while you do it. Good. See, that's how long it takes. Thank you very much.
Excellent.
So please do that,
excellent.
Right? Thank you. You raising that, Jerry? I'd have to rate it as excellent.
Yep.
And our book is for sale, on sale at Amazon, The Annotated Abbott and Costello. And again, you can get this movie in the Universal Collection on Blu-ray or DVD. And enjoy your Abbott and Costello, regardless, okay? In the meantime, thank you, everyone, for being a part of this and for joining us again. And, oh, can I say one more thing before I leave? I'm sure you will. I'm on a road trip right now. I'm trying to recuperate from the fall I had and the scalping I gave myself. And as I was driving up here, which takes about 24 hours, I listened to 20 of our podcasts, the first 20 of our podcasts. And wow. I have to admit that when I'm a guest on a podcast, which I'm on several, I can't listen. I listen for about 10 minutes and I can't listen anymore because I don't want to hear myself. I really can't. I'm it's weird. But our podcast, I think it's really good. I was entertained the entire way. I don't know what that says for you and I, Jerry, or you and me. We're just entertaining fellows.
I guess, yeah.
If you love the boys like we do, there's no better place to come. So come next time, Abbott and Costello meet Captain Kidd. Everybody, take care. Be healthy. Don't have any sleepwalking accidents. And we'll see you next time. Bye-bye, all.
Eskimo men are courageous when they head out for the open sea. Eskimo, she's just waiting free, saying, blubber, come back to me. The young and the old face the bitter cold, and they know they must not fail.
Get a sharp harpoon and a serving spoon. I want to help the whale.
There'll be a hard time in the igloo tonight. You know, a hard time in the igloo tonight. Pulling your stylish icicle bill for two. We'll have a wing ding in the igloo tonight. We'll fling a swing thing till the temperature is high. So although a blizzard may blow the zero out of sight, there'll be a hard time in the igloo tonight. Everything inside.